Reminder items before we begin the technical portion of today's broadcast. Again, you should be joining us for today's RCRA Corrective Action Inspection Training, which has been sponsored by the U.S. EPA's Office of Enforcement and Compliance Assurance with their Office of Site Remediation and Enforcement. My name is Jean Balance, and I'll be co-moderating today's session with Zena Aldridge. In just a few moments, I'll turn things over to Zena so she can introduce our first speakers and kick off today's session. But before we do, let's walk through a few reminders for those of you who may be new to these webinars. If you are unsure how to participate in today's webinar, I'll refer you back to a registration or reminder email that you should have received for today's training. That email will point you to something known as the seminar homepage, where you can read a complete description of today's session. You'll find contact information and bios for the instructors. There are also links to download the presentation materials right from that seminar homepage. It does contain copies of the speaker notes that will be used for today's training, so I encourage you to download a copy if you're the kind of person who likes to take notes or is looking for those reference materials. There will also, again, be speaker bios and contact information, links to a short feedback form, but for now you want to click a button that appears in the upper left corner of that page labeled Go to Seminar. Once you click that button, you will be asked to identify yourself by name, as well as the number of people at your location, and you should then be successfully checked in online and brought to our Adobe Connect environment that we'll be using for the live broadcast. The entire broadcast can be watched through Adobe Connect as our presenters walk through these slides in real time. There will also be interactive questions posed to the audience, where we'll ask you to actually click on and answer these questions as a group. If you have technical problems joining us online through Adobe Connect, you can simply download the materials and follow along on the phone lines. But I encourage you to send us an email so that we can try to troubleshoot any issues you might have to get you on board for that live broadcast. By default, everyone can listen to today's session using their computer speakers or a pair of headphones. If you have problems with the online audio, please check your local volume settings first. Sometimes you need to increase the speaker output in your sound control panel. Other participants have reported wearing headphones that can dramatically help increase the volume level. If that doesn't solve your problem, though, we do have a toll-free call-in line that you may use. Feel free to request it using the question and answer window that appears in the lower right corner of your screen. Just know if you join us on the phone lines, you will be placed on a global mute, and we ask that you remain on that global mute to minimize background noises and other audio disruptions. As I alluded to earlier, there will be, or should be, on your screen in the lower right corner, an interactive Q&A window. There should be a welcome message from me when you first join us. You can use that Q&A window to privately submit comments, questions, as well as to report technical problems at any time. Feel free to test that tool out now by clicking on the empty box at the bottom of the Q&A window and sending in either a test message or let us know how the audio and visuals are coming through for you. When you're done typing up your message, you simply need to hit the Enter key or press the cartoon bubble button to the right, and again, that privately submits your message in. There will be designated breaks for Q&A, and at that time, we'll read through the questions and address them out loud, but there's no need to wait for the breaks. I encourage you to submit your questions as soon as they occur to you throughout today's live broadcast. Today's session is being recorded, and you'll automatically receive an archive as soon as that recorded version is available. But if you can't wait, you're certainly welcome to browse the nearly 600 previously recorded webinars that we have available on our site. Just a quick visual reminder, you will see a copy of the presentation materials here on the far left of your screen. If you can't see the materials, there's a button that appears in the upper right corner. It looks like four arrows pointing in opposite directions. You can click that four arrow button once to make the slides bigger. You can hover in that same area to bring the button back and click it a second time to shrink it back down. You can feel free to expand the slides as needed to increase your viewing. And then again, you'll see information about our sponsors and presenters in the upper right. There'll be a collection of related URLs here in the middle. You can click on any one of those websites and press the Browse To button to open them up locally. And then our interactive Q&A window, which appears here in the lower right corner of your screen. I think that's the end of the technical reminders that I have for today's broadcast. So I think we're going to actually launch right into today's training with our first speaker, unless, Zena, you want to share anything with the audience.
No, I'm going to go ahead and start.
Okay, excellent. So let me turn everyone over to our very first presenter today, who will be Phil Page. And Phil, whenever you're ready, please feel free to begin.
Okay, thank you, Jean, and thank you to all the participants who have signed on and are going to spend the next 2 hours to us Special thanks to Jean Ballant, who is the Clue-In guru, who's just been speaking. She's made the technical presentation possible. And also special thanks to our presenters. This is a collaborative effort by OSRE at EPA headquarters, the Office of Site Remediation Enforcement. We work with the regions and our state partners who are represented by SWAMO. And in fact, our state partners are going to be leading off the presentation. And I want to give you a little bit of bio on our presenters. First up will be Penny Wilson. Penny is the section chief. She's the branch manager for the enforcement and inspection branch for the Arkansas Department of Environmental Quality. She has been with ADEQ since 1991. She has literally had over 100 inspections. She will be doing the first part of the presentation. She'll be introducing corrective action concepts and oversight ideas. Following her will be Tammy Heinem, who is also with ADEQ. Tammy's been there since 1990. She's also done probably over 100 inspections. She is the chief of the Hazardous Waste Division for ADEQ. Our regional representatives will be Mike Beadle, who will be presenting, conducting a corrective action inspection and preparing for the corrective action inspection and then actually conducting it. Mike is a 17-year veteran with EPA. He has been a corrective action project manager. He's a senior RCRA inspector and is currently serving as an acting section chief in Region 5. He will be followed by Chuck Figure, who is an attorney with EPA in Region 8. Chuck has been with EPA since 1988. He's a senior RCRA enforcement attorney. He advises not only the agency, but states, tribal nations on complex RCRA matters. He's a participant on a lot of national work groups in RCRA matters and has presented on RCRA issues before a national audience. So as each speaker finishes his or her portion, they will then turn it over to the next speaker without any further introduction. So again, the first speaker will be Penny Wilson, who will be introducing RCRA concepts. And again, thank you for your participation here. So Penny, take it away.
Before Penny starts, I want to ask everyone to participate in one of our polls. We'll have several polls during our two-hour session. So when you see them pop up on your screen, just go ahead and answer to the best of your ability, and we will broadcast the results so we can see how the majority of people are answering. And it looks like we've got a lot of folks that are new to this work. Maybe you are in the RCRA program but haven't done any corrective action inspection. And we do have some senior people. We're glad to see some of our experts on the line for today, too. Just a note that we are doing this training primarily for RCRA people that are in the program that maybe are inspectors but are not as familiar with the corrective action side of the program. And so things are going to be basic. This is definitely an introduction course. Thanks for all of your replies. And Tammy. No, Penny's going to be first, right?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Zena and Phil. Our goal today is to discuss corrective action and the importance of inspecting facilities to make sure that regulatory and permit requirements are being followed. Our training will provide a fundamental understanding of the corrective action process from start to finish. An emphasis will also be placed on the inspections of corrective action sites. The inspection should include an evaluation of the effectiveness of the current approach as well as recommendations to troubleshoot stalled investigations or remedy selections, as well as the ineffective corrective action measures or remedies. The training today is intended for a broad audience of federal and state personnel who have responsibility for ensuring compliance with corrective action requirements. Those folks include EPA project managers, state inspectors or project managers, permit writers, attorneys who handle corrective action cases, and this is for both new and experienced personnel that will introductory training and then a refresher for those that are more experienced. The states and EPA require the investigation and cleanup or remediation of releases of or at hazardous waste facilities, and we call this cleanup process corrective action. And corrective action, the program nationally is focused on almost 4,000 facilities. Some examples include current and former chemical manufacturing plants, oil refineries, lead smelters, wood preservers, steel mills, commercial landfills, and then other types of facilities. The sites range in size from less than 1 acre to in excess of 2 million acres. The oversight responsibilities primarily rest on the states and EPA. Right now, there's a total of 43 states that are authorized to implement the corrective action program. Some of the those states that are not authorized are New Jersey, Maryland, Pennsylvania, Mississippi, Iowa, Nebraska, and Alaska. Also, the District of Columbia is not authorized to implement the corrective action program. So in those cases, EPA region or headquarters offices would carry out that implementation. Authorized states or the EPA offices must also ensure that the corrective action is implemented and completed timely and accurately. Corrective action oversight is the management of all of the activities that are related to corrective action at the site and primarily consist of reviewing documents such as work plans, RFI work plans and reports, conducting visual inspections throughout the entire process at the facilities. The official definition of the corrective action inspection is an evaluation of a site's compliance with the corrective action requirements of a permit or order. Some other types of inspections that can include a corrective action component would be a CEI or compliance evaluation inspection, which is your on-site evaluation of compliance at a facility with regard either to the regulations or permits. One could be a groundwater monitoring evaluation or a GME, which is a detailed evaluation of the adequacy of the design and operation of a site's groundwater monitoring system. There's also the operation and maintenance inspection, or OAM, as we lovingly like to call them, which is a periodic inspection of how well a groundwater monitoring system is functioning. There are a few differences between a RCRA credentialed inspector and a corrective action project manager, and these are federal guidelines, and states may have different guidelines or statutory authority regarding their inspection authority, but the federal guidelines include for inspections, is requesting the site to provide information, copying information, entering the site at reasonable times, and inspecting the site or collecting samples. And inspectors at a federal level or under these federal guidelines must go through specific training and credentialing process. And if a credentialed inspector arrives at a site and is denied access to the site, then a search warrant could be sought to gain access. And this authority is provided under RCRA of Section 3007. So in some cases, your corrective action project manager may not be credentialed, so would not be authorized to conduct inspections under RCRA 3007, but EPA in some states, or that's for EPA in some states that follow the federal guidelines. And as I said earlier, some states may have different statutory authority for authorized representatives of the state agency and what they can and cannot do as far as their access to a facility or collecting samples or information, things like that. Under federal authority, a site that is not under a permit order agreement could voluntarily allow a corrective action project manager on the site, but the site could also deny access without any repercussions, whereas if they tried to deny access to a credentialed inspector, there would be some repercussions, one of which would be a search warrant and usually follow up with penalties and things like that. And again, that's not necessarily the case in all states. At this point, that's the end of the introduction, so I'm going to pass the baton to Tammy Hynum.
All right. In this section, Section 2, we're going to actually cover what's involved in a typical corrective action process. Now, I'm using the word typical because it's important to understand that the steps that we're going to talk about here today, they can be conducted individually or they can be combined in a variety of several different ways. So typical corrective action process, we're just going to talk about the overarching steps and requirements that are typically involved in that. Obviously, as you see on the slide, the first step is a RCRA facility assessment, which then leads you to a RCRA facility investigation. All right. Once your facility investigation is complete, the next step would be to determine how are you actually going to clean up the site. You have several processes that you can look at there. There's interim measures, then there's corrective measure studies, and in the corrective measure study, you're actually evaluating several remedies against one another, and you want to propose or select the best one or a combination thereof. The next step, once your decision is made, is to issue a statement of basis, which leads to a public comment period. Then you have a final decision, which in Arkansas and many states, that's considered your remedial action decision document. Some states call it a remedial action memorandum, but basically it's a final decision where you as the regulated entity is letting the general public and the facility know, here's the history of your site, these are the remedies we've evaluated against one another, and based off these problems at the site, these are the recommended remedies that we anticipate to be put into place at the facility. That is typically, once you've made that remedy decision and the regulatory agency has put out that decision document, is when you can go into RCRA Info, which is the database that contains all of our step-by-step processes that we do, And that's coded typically as a corrective action 400 or CA 400. Now, once you're ready to put the plan into action, is basically your corrective measures implementation. That's when you get into remedy construction. You're actually getting in there and implementing what your remedial final decision document said that you needed to do, and you're tracking all the appropriate processes. And then at that point, obviously, you come to a point where your corrective action process has been terminated. Let's talk a little bit more detail now that we've kind of gone over a quick summary of the typical process. Let's talk about step one here. Step one in the corrective action process, as I mentioned earlier, is the record facility assessment, or I'll refer to it as an RFA, or just a facility assessment in the future. This is basically an initial site assessment. You're going through the entire facility, and you're gathering information. What does my site look like? Have I had any releases of hazardous waste? Do I have any areas where there may be potential releases to occur in the future or near time frame? What exposure pathways do I have? And do I actually think I actually need some type of cleanup? And while you're doing that facility assessment, it's very common to identify three primary units, if you'll allow me to use that terminology. One is the solid waste management unit, and with my southern twang, I call it a SMU. These are units that where any waste has been placed at any time, irrespective of whether it was solid waste or hazardous waste. That's real important to know. Just that you have a unit that at any point in time of the operating life of the facility, they manage some type of solid or hazardous waste routinely in this area, or there may have been some releases at some point. Then you have hazardous waste management units. Obviously, these are a subset of your solid waste management units, and these would be specific to having contained hazardous waste. Then you have just generalized area of concern. It wasn't necessarily any type of unit that contained solid waste or that had hazardous waste in it, but it's an area at the site that at some point in time, there appeared to be some type of a deliberate or accidental release or spill that occurred, and it just looks suspicious. So you want to identify that area of concern inside your facility assessment. You've got to document any evidence of releases. And I think the important thing to note here, obviously the veterans on the webinar realize this, but as new folks, understand this is a process that is generally conducted by the state or EPA. This is not something that the facility does. We go in and we're doing this generalized assessment of the facility and getting a feel for the lay of the land. So then after we get through with the facility assessment, obviously the second step is we need to go in and actually do an investigation. This is when the facility, the owner, operator, the responsible party, however you want to term it, this is they're going in and actually investigating all of these areas that we as regulators have identified at the facility. The first thing that they're typically going to do is submit to you a record facility inspection work plan. This is going to basically be a sampling and analysis plan that they're telling us as the regulators, here's the generalized approach that we're going to take to investigate all of the SMUs, the hazardous waste management units, area of concerns, and anything else that you brought up during your facility assessment that needs to be investigated. Typically, during the RFI work plan, it's common that a facility will also include their human health and ecological protocol or work plan. This will help them explain to you up front before they go out and actually get in the field and start collecting their data, once the data comes in, how they're actually going to evaluate any potential exposure pathways and potential risk to human health and or the environment. The goal, obviously, in an RFI is to gather enough data to support a corrective measure study or any interim measures that are forthcoming in the future. And obviously to gather representative sampling. I mean, obviously some of your common type samples, it's anywhere from groundwater, surface soils, your subsurface soils, soil gas testing, and surface water, and then obviously some air is not uncommon if you're dealing with some units at the facility that may have some emission issues. And then when you get into more ecological investigations, it's extremely common to pull some benthic samples in the sediments of any of the streams. I think of importance to note here is you see the terminology surface soil, then you see the terminology subsurface. Subsurface is obviously related to soil as well, but it is typically deemed to be subsurface when it's 6 inches or greater in depth from the ground down. So just keep that in mind. Let's talk about a case example. And actually the one that I'm fixing to introduce to you is a manufacturing facility that obviously is no longer in business in Arkansas, but we are working with them on some pretty extensive corrective action at the facility. They used to deal with refrigerators, trash compactors, and ice makers. And we were basically dealing with trichloroethylene TCE. It's in the soils, mainly surface-wise, and it's also in the groundwater. And we have a pretty extensive groundwater plume of TCE, and obviously we're identifying the extent of the plume of the TCE at the point that the levels that we're testing in the groundwater are still in excess of the MCLs, which is the maximum contaminant level. Key thing to remember in this case study as we talk about this through the rest of this section is that not only do we have the groundwater plume on-site, but we have a groundwater plume that has gone off-site north of the main building of this facility, and it is underneath a residential area. One of the things that you want to have during your facility investigation is a pictorial conceptual site model. And so you have an example of one up here on your screen. You kind of look and you see all of the potential pathways that you can get to a human exposure. And, you know, it can either be through groundwater ingestion from the site, any type of vapor intrusion, which is primarily when you have a contaminated plume of a volatile constituent underlying your building that you're investigating, and it's actually the vapors are so strong and highly concentrated that they're coming up through the building by obviously several different viable means and causing a inhalation potential risk there. You have groundwater contact with waters. Obviously with any facility you have workers. Even if the facility is abandoned, it's not uncommon to have a trespasser scenario. So you have a soil contact as far as the surface soil goes. You also equally have to balance what you're evaluating from a potential human exposure standpoint. Current day, you have to kind of look at the aspect of what's going to happen in the future, because that's going to help you establish what your ultimate cleanup standards are going to be for the site that you're working on. So for this particular case, we had routine workers, obviously maintenance workers, and then we had construction workers that would be coming and going both current day and in the future that we needed to evaluate as we were establishing the need for any interim measures or how our actual corrective measure studies would lay out. And then as I mentioned, the groundwater plume extended off-site north of the main building of the facility. So obviously number one person we wanted to look at was the residences. Then you have off-site routine workers and maintenance workers. You know, you have city utility workers, It could be a whole plethora of folks that people, residences may hire to work in their yard. So those are folks that we needed to evaluate as well. So we wanted to get those out on a map. So it's really good to sketch it out on paper, conceptually, what you think your exposure routes are and the pathways and so forth. But it's also equally important to put it on paper and try to schematically map it out. I'm of the school that, a picture is worth a thousand words. So this is something that I think would help you out drastically to put it on paper in print, but to also have a conceptual site picture. Okay, we're at the third step now, the corrective action process. We've talked about our facility assessment. We've talked about our facility investigation. And now we need to evaluate if there's any type of interim measures that may need to take place. This is the process of controlling or abating any known ongoing risk in advance of actually introducing a full-fledged remedy. So I would refer to interim measures as hotspot removals a lot of times. Interim measures can have a role in your final remedy, but a lot of times you're just asking the owner or operator of the facility, obviously subject to state and EPA approval, you're asking them to implement interim measures because this is something that can be taken care of now and should not have to wait to where you may actually increase any potential risk that you have both to a human health or environmental standpoint. So I'll just say real quick, carrying forward with the case example that I presented to you on a couple of slides back, this facility historically has done some hotspot removals, as I would term it, or interim measures, step three of our process, by removing some of the highly saturated, contaminated soils on site that we felt was a major contributor to the elevated levels of the TCE that we kept seeing in the groundwater. So they wanted to do a hotspot removal of the soils to see if they could basically abate or control what was the source area of the plume that we were seeing go off-site and gradually get a little bit larger. So obviously, interim measures can take place within the corrective action management units, or CAMUs. These are special units that the Resource Conservation and Recovery, or RCRA, regulations allow. Basically, a facility can treat, store, or dispose of hazardous waste, their cleanup waste, in these CAMUs. It's a way of while the CAMUs are rare, let's just say CAMUs are rare, but it is a good option for interim measures because of the flexibility that it can offer to dealing with remediation waste. You see an example here of a RCRA cap in Kent, Washington. And I was trying to think back. I think in Arkansas, over my years of dealing with the RCRA process and corrective action, I can probably think of two facilities that took advantage of using a corrective action management unit to deal with some of their remediation waste. And I must say, it was a flexible thing for them to be able to do, and I would have to say it was an effective, and it appeared to be productive for those two scenarios. Obviously, you can deal with solid waste management units and areas of concern during the interim measures. This can be anywhere from what we talked about, hotspot removals, kind of like the waste extraction, where you've actually just have a saturated free product, go do some waste extraction. You can actually try to do some type of physical containment. A lot of times that's barrier systems or some type of fencing that occurs. So at the same site that we've been talking about this morning, or this afternoon now, I guess, where we talked about some of the hotspot removals in the soil, basically the primary intent was to lower the concentration of the groundwater like we talked about. So I want to advance you to the next slide and take a look at the plume map before removal. Now, I know this is a little small, but I'm going to try to walk you through this. Toward the upper part of the screen, not quite halfway down, you're going to see a dashed black line that's running from left to right. That's actually the site boundary. If you'll look around the middle portion of the picture, you're going to see some deep purple or red coloring. That's what I'm going to call the hot spot of the plume. That's where you have your most concentrated level of the TCE constituent that we were talking about. And that's where they were actually going in and focusing on doing the removals of the soil. So their intent was to be able to, obviously, again, lower the levels of TCE in the groundwater. So as an interim measure, the facility also attempted, along with their hotspot removal, what you call in situ chemical oxidation. That's basically, along with the hotspot removal, they wanted to inject some chemicals into the ground at certain injection points and see if they could somehow alter the concentrations of the TCE in the plume. Now, obviously, the MCL, the maximum contaminant level allowed for TCE in the groundwater, is 5 parts per billion or 0.005 parts per million. And if you'll look at the, you see some red and purple dots down toward the bottom of the map. Area 1, we're dealing with the TCE concentration of anywhere from 1 to greater than 10 parts per million. I want to repeat for you here. We're dealing with concentrations here in this area between 1 and greater than 10 parts per million. Our criteria is 0.005. In Area 2, which you see a little bit up above Area 1 there, probably around midway of the near the site boundary, you've got TCE concentration at 0.1 to 1 part per million. So we're getting better in Area 2 as far as the extremely high levels of TCE, but we're still, at 1 ppm, we're still extensively higher than the 0.005 where we want it to be. Then when you get off-site, you're up north of that dashed line that you see there on your slide, you're getting into the residential areas, and we're dealing with TCE concentrations of 0.1 to 1 ppm as well. So whereas the levels approaching the site boundary and going off-site are a lot lower than the levels that we have in Area 1, where we've been focusing some of the chemical oxidation processes and removals, they're still a lot higher than the level that we're comfortable with from the establishment of the MCLs for TCE being 0.005. All right, so let's see. We've gone over a facility assessment. We've gone over our facility investigation. We've talked about some interim measures that we could take. We are ready to do a corrective measure study. This is where we're actually going to analyze a wide range of alternatives, and we're going to look at their pros and cons, for lack of a better term. What are the advantages of this, and what are the disadvantages of this? And by this, I mean any of the alternatives, remedies that we're looking at. Again, this fourth step in the corrective action process is a responsibility to be conducted by the owner and operator of the facility. Obviously, our role in this, as states and EPA, are to review it and approve it. There are typically 8 factors here that I want to go through with you real quick that are commonly looked at when you're evaluating your alternatives against one another, where you're trying to figure out what's good about this alternative in relation to this site and the conditions that we're dealing with, and then you also have to look at what's bad about this alternative. And then you can also look at coupling alternatives together. But real quick, those eight factors, the first thing you want to look at is you want to figure out overall protection of human health and the environment. Obviously, our ultimate goal and objective is cleaning up the site, and we want that cleanup to be protective of human health and the environment. So that's the first thing that we look at as regulators when we're evaluating what type of remedy that we might want to have implemented at the site. The second thing you need to look at is if they implement this remedy, can they be in compliance with the state rules and regs? That's important, and obviously the federal rules and regs as well. You want to know that this remedy, you need to evaluate its long-term effectiveness, but equally important, we need to evaluate its short-term effectiveness. We need to kind of figure out if we're doing some type of treatment, how are we evaluating any reduction if we were to utilize this certain alternative in regards to toxicity, mobility, or the actual volume of the waste. How easy is it to implement is another factor. Certainly a factor that the facility is looking at is what does it cost? And then last but certainly not least, we need to evaluate those alternatives, listening to community feedback and acceptance that we're getting through a lot of our public meetings and venues where we're reaching out with them. If you've got two alternatives that are identical on all eight factors that we've just talked about, with the exception of cost, there certainly has never been any question for us that you can go with the least expensive of the two. But cost should never be a factor if you're jeopardizing any type of compliance issues, protection issues, or long-term or short-term effectiveness. So just keep that in mind. Cost alone by itself is one of eight criteria that we're looking at. So it should never be the sole leading factor on how things advance. Obviously, there's some activities under the corrective measure study that you don't have to involve a lab or any type of field work, and then some you do. So I think what you'll see on your slide is two examples of a, there's a bench study, and that's a laboratory scale study. And then there's the pilot scale study, and this is where you're actually evaluating treatment type potentials and advancements based on actual site conditions that you have. This is more realistic, you know, to your site that you're dealing with. Now, for this site in Arkansas, we have been discussing a pilot scale study and evaluating which would be the actual most effective in situ chemical oxidation to use. And by that I mean I'll give you four quick types of chemicals that could be injected. You could have permanganate oxide. There's a fenton oxide, which is really just a hydrogen peroxide and ferrous iron type mixture. You have an ozone oxide and a persulfate oxide. We've done several types of injections at this facility, and the one that appears to be the most effective at this point is the persulfate oxide. So that's the one that ADEQ put into our remedial action decision document, and we're asking the facility to inject this at the approved, pre-approved type injection points on-site and some of it off-site, and to actually gather some information. Now, from this corrective measure study for this facility in Arkansas, the way that we have the remedial action decision set up is we're okay right now for you to go out and try this in situ chemical oxidation process, do your injections, collect your data, do your little bit of hotspot removal, see if you can reduce your sourcing to the groundwater. But at some point, and I think it's around a 2.5 or 3 year period, it's either working or it's not. And if the statistical trend does not lean in favor that things have been effective with that type of alternative, then we're going to give the facility written notice that they've got a 45-day period to submit us a another alternative to implement out of the site, one that might be a little bit more aggressive other than some type of injection and monitoring. One thing that I wanted to mention at this point on the fourth step, you know, we're getting into a lot of areas here. You know, we've gone out and done this huge facility assessment, a lot of investigation, soils, groundwater, subsurface soils, some benthic sampling and so forth. We've gotten into some hotspot removals, our interim measures. We've started evaluating alternatives against one another, doing some pilot scale studies. No one person or no one discipline actually can do all of this effectively by themselves and deal with other things going on as well. So one of the things that I have found throughout the years that is effective is when you're dealing with the corrective action process, it's really important to have a team approach. You need to have inspectors involved. You need to have your geologists involved. You need to have your engineers, your risk assessors, a chemist. And it's real important sometimes to even have your legal staff involved up front, because while you're going through all these steps that we're discussing here today, there's public scrutiny going on, there's public meetings, there's requests for hearings taking place, and the sooner your legal staff's involved in getting up to speed on where you are, the preparation and getting in and addressing the needs and moving forward, it's just obviously just a little bit more effective in my personal experience. You know, both the pilot test at this site in Arkansas showed the TCE could be treated by the in-situ chemical oxidation, but we were seeing that the treatment had some limited positive impact on the TCE plume, and a lot of that had to do with the actual characteristics of the aquifer that was actually underlying, you know, the facility. So as you recall, I think about five slides ago on slide 21, we showed the plume at the site before we had done any type of removal. And you can see here in 2012 example of the plume map that you have up on the screen, it kind of looks the same. So I think the important thing to notice here is from 2012 to current day as we're entering into 2015, you know, we've seen the northeast corner of this groundwater plume actually extend, and what I'll call the purple hotspot, the part that we talked about earlier, right there close to the center point of your map, we've actually seen that increase a little bit. And there's actually an off-site Boys and Girls Club east of this site, and we're seeing some contamination in the groundwater headed that way, and it's slightly trending up above the MCL. So, you know, needless to say, there's been quite a bit of outreach to them, both from a regulatory standpoint, and the facility themselves has stepped up. We're meeting quarterly with the city officials and getting them updates, and then obviously more often if needed. So we're keeping a close eye on the site from a corrective action process, and it's definitely been a challenge. So we've done our investigation, our interim measures. We've prepared our corrective measure study, which is our remedial action decision document. And our next step is, well, let me back up. The corrective measure study is actually evaluating the alternatives against one another. And our next step right now is we need to decide as regulators what our final remedy is going to be. That's basically a statement of basis. The state or EPA actually drafts this, and you're basically seeking input from the public on a proposed final remedy that you think is the best solution for this site that you're dealing with. Keep in mind what we've talked about. It can be one remedy, or it can be several remedies coupled together, or it could be two separate remedies on two separate parts of your site. This is the point. This is your remedial action decision document. You're writing this document for the public and giving them a abstract summary of everything that's occurred, everything that you've looked at, all the problems at the site, and what you propose to solve the problem and how long you anticipate it would take. You're putting that out there for public comment, anywhere from a 45 to 60 day period. What your RAD or your decision document, whatever you choose to call it, at a minimum, you want to touch on the site background. You want to give a summary of your human health and ecological risk. You want to give a summary of the remedial approach. You want to talk about the alternatives that were evaluated and looked at for the site. Remember, this is where we're saying, here's the advantages if we use this one, here's the disadvantages if we use this one, and there were eight factors that we looked at. So you want to tell them how each one of these remedies that you looked at, how it matched up to those eight factors. You want to propose or recommend a remedy or remedies. You want to tell the public what your action levels are going to be. You want to give them your justification for that scientifically. You want to talk about a effective monitoring program to ensure that the remedy or remedies that you proposed are effective, the schedule, and then kind of a community outreach public participation section of your decision document. Those are 10 recommendations that we have found in Arkansas to be pretty all-inclusive and effective. We're on the last step now. We are ready to get out in the field and actually implement everything that we've spent a considerable amount of time evaluating. We're going to get out there and evaluate, talk about the remedy design, remedy construction, operation and maintenance, and then getting this all said and done. And again, this last and final step in the corrective action process, this is something that is expected to be conducted by the owner or operator of the facility, and typically it's just oversighted by the state and EPA regulators. My experience, more often than not, it's one or more remedies typically that you're dealing with during your corrective measures implementation. It's very common for it to be on and off site. And it's equally important to know that your corrective measures implementation, which is, you know, your remedy designs and all the completions and how we're going to clean up things, these can include either or both institutional controls and engineering controls. I think what I would remind everybody here of, that I try to remind myself of daily as we're going through these selection processes and implementing things, is institution controls and engineering controls are great things, and they can be just as protective as more expensive and egregious type remedies, but you do have to evaluate them minimally on an annual basis. You need to make sure that they're still in effect and in place and serving the intended purpose that they were put into place for. Some common activities that we're dealing with during corrective measures implementation, we've talked about a little bit of them. Let's just go through a few other type of examples. There's capping of the landfill. Do you remember the picture that we looked at that I think took place somewhere in Washington? There's fire remediation, which is an in-situ type process. There's soil vapor extraction. You've got the excavation of contaminated soils, kind of more extensive than a hotspot issue. This may be a larger area that you're dealing with. But those are just some examples that you're dealing with during your implementation phase. During our actual case study in Arkansas, just to kind of wrap things up and kind of give you an example of where we are, we looked at several different remedies. We looked at a no action. We looked at institutional controls by themselves. We looked at soils from a containment or removal aspect. And then on the groundwater, we looked at the extraction, this in situ chemical oxidation that we talked about, permeable beds, some type of enhanced biodegradation. And then obviously one that we always evaluate when it comes to groundwater is monitoring and natural attenuation. Now, you know, I'm of the opinion that monitoring natural attenuation has a purpose and a place. Sometimes it's just not as of an active remedy that you need. It's a little bit more passive. So it's pretty common to pair up monitor natural attenuation with like an in-situ chemical oxidation. And that's actually what we're actually doing at this case study site in Arkansas that we've been talking about. They're using the sodium persulfate to actually oxidize the contaminant, the TCE that's in the groundwater, and then they're kind of hoping that natural attenuation will kind of play in their favor as well. So obviously that's everything that we looked at that we're going to do. We also, outside of the, or in addition to the in situ and monitoring natural attenuation, we looked at an asphalt cover over some of the hot spots of soil that they could not remove due to some building integrity issues. We've coupled that with some soil gas monitoring, and then obviously their site-wide institutional controls. Obviously, the site-wide institutional controls, again, we're requiring those to be monitored yearly as long as the facility is on site doing any work, and then at the point that they're not there, we will do probably a year or a five-year oversight case review and look to make sure our IC is still in place. Obviously, some of you may have picked up on that early on in this project, we did some chemical oxidation injections, and we found that we had some problems with the characteristic of our aquifer, and things didn't work so well. And so why did ADEQ let the facility do this again in a remedy? It's, number one, it's a different chemical being injected, and number two, we have more than tripled the number of injection points, and we are actually seeing some positive aspects and numbers returning there. We're doing some soil gas monitoring, as I mentioned, and we're not seeing any vapor concerns appearing at the site right now, which is good news. And we are seeing the groundwater data on decline, but it appears to be really isolated around the numerous injection points that we've put in. So we're asking for some additional injection points and replacing a couple because of some water issues, actually, in those wells. So I think things are progressing really well. I must say the facility is being fairly cooperative with us. It probably helps that we issued an order. And I think we've made some good progress, particularly from 2012 to, I would say, December this past year, because we actually were starting to get in the field and starting to see some progress. It takes a while to go through those first couple of steps that we've talked about, but once you hit the CMI phase, you can really progress forward. So that is all that I have for you today, and so I guess I will turn this over to Zena to see if she's got some questions for y'all.
Actually, we're going to do another poll question, if you all would take a look at the screen and answer that. And then I've got a couple of questions that have come in. Thank you for all of you that are typing in questions in the Q&A box. If we can't get to them verbally, we will be working on them after the fact and reach out to you and get that information to you later. Nicole has asked, what about unauthorized states? How does corrective action get implemented in those states? Corrective action is implemented in several ways. One is that EPA will take care of that portion of the RCRA permits, but the states may be involved in corrective action in some other ways, including some work-sharing activities. So there are different ways that a state could still be involved, even though EPA would be the lead. Another question was asked by Joe Tammy, Joe wants to know if the site in Arkansas that you are talking about has achieved the CA 725 and the CA 750 environmental indicators.
Well, Joe, that's a good question. Technically, this site did not make our GPARA list that EPA developed for us for our 08 and 2020 sites. However, we in Arkansas still track all of our sites through that similar type process. Yes, we have been able to code the 725. The 750, we're waiting to see how our groundwater tests go in 2015. And we'll reevaluate on whether or not we feel confident on coding the CA 750, which is obviously groundwater migration under control. And obviously, we've done our CA 400 because we did issue a remedial action decision document, and it was that document that we incorporated into a order requiring the facility to implement it.
Great, thanks. One other question. Rebecca's asked, how long has this case been going on? If you could give folks an idea of that.
Gosh, I'm trying to, I want to say it was the early 90s when the facility approached us that they had discovered that they had a TCE groundwater problem, and we started commencing the investigation. I'm going to say around the 93 to 95 time frame that they think the incident occurred, and we probably have been working actually in the field detailed investigations, I'd say from 97 forward.
All right. We're going to end the poll, and most of you got it right, all the above. All of those things were covered as activities that you would do to prepare for an inspection. And now we're going to ask Mike Beadle from our Chicago office to come and talk about the actual inspection.
Mike, if you're there on the phone lines, remember you will need to take yourself off of mute so that we can hear you.
Yes, on mute, so I'll have
there
to do my
go.
Introduction again. I thought I pushed mute, but it was still blinking red. First, I want to thank you all for participating in the seminar today. I do have a bad cold. If I stop making sense during the seminar, I am blaming it on the cold and not the content or my delivery style. Today I will be discussing preparing for, conducting, and reporting out of corrective action inspections. I will be presenting this information as if I'm talking directly with an inspector. It is my experience that the preparation that you do beforehand is a key determining factor whether or not an inspection is successful, and that goes for both corrective action inspections and normal large quantity generator inspections or TSD inspections. It is best to begin with the end in mind, understand what information is needed to determine compliance with or to prove violation of corrective action obligation. You should start your preparation at least 30 days prior to the inspection. You must clearly understand all of the ongoing corrective action activities at the facility prior to the inspection. The obligations you will be inspecting are site-specific, much more so than a routine, for example, large quantity generator inspection. The actual preparation time required will vary depending on the site and how familiar you are with the site. The more compliance points that you will be inspecting equals more time needed to prepare and to conduct the actual inspection. The course developers understand that the states and regional corrective action programs vary in organizational structure, whereas the inspector might be a corrective action project manager or might only be a RCRA inspector. If the inspector is not a project manager, the project manager must be consulted prior to the inspection to obtain the current site status and requirements. Conversely, the project manager has the responsibility to ensure the inspector has the site's information and understands the corrective action requirements at the site. The project manager and inspector should work together to identify priority and focus areas of the inspection. Additionally, the inspector, enforcement officer, project manager, and assigned attorney should work closely after the inspection to determine compliance or non-compliance of the site. The purpose of the inspection is always to determine compliance with a permit or order or regulatory requirements. During your preparation, you should identify specific areas and activities that need to be inspected. You should be prepared to identify any new waste management units or releases. You should be ready to inspect caps, cleanup operations, and land and groundwater use restrictions. During a normal record inspection of a site that is not undergoing corrective action, you should be prepared to identify any releases and determine if the site is subject to corrective action by checking the status in record info or any permit or order. EPA is measuring intermediate success of the program against two environmental indicators, current human exposure control, or CA 725, and migration of contaminated groundwater under control, or CA 750 in record info. During your preparation, you should determine if the site has human health or groundwater EIs and determine how you would confirm or verify any such of these determinations during the inspection. During your preparation, you should determine the corrective action activities being conducted by the owner-operator. Some of the questions you should explore include: what phase of corrective action is the site at? Is it in the facility investigation? Is it conducting the corrective measure study? Are corrective measures being implemented? And often some of the inspections we're focusing out on in Region 5 are operation and maintenance phase, CA, post-CA 550 corrective action inspections. One of the things you'll be looking for as you prepare is, does the site have interim measures or remedies constructed? You should be aware that there are always potential issues in long-term operation and maintenance at a site. And during Region 5's investigation of some of these O&M sites, we are finding there are some problems. The basic question is, has the company stopped operating or maintaining any remedies? For example, groundwater pump and treat systems. Have they stopped maintaining them? Have they stopped pumping groundwater? Any required engineering controls, institutional controls, and financial assurance should be evaluated during your inspection. You should be prepared to evaluate the effectiveness of remedies and whether or not environmental indicators are still being met. If conditions have changed at the facility that cause one or more or both of the EIs to be questionable, the inspector should document the changed conditions at the facility. And if appropriate, a new EI determination should be performed. As you prepare, you should identify specific resources necessary to conduct an on-site inspection. This includes a site map, which includes the area concerns and solid waste management units identified on it, the inspection tools such as notebooks, checklists, cameras, and protective gear. If sampling is planned, make arrangements in advance with appropriate personnel and lab. At EPA, you are expected to develop a health and safety plan, a sampling analysis plan, and a quality assurance project plan for when there is a sampling event. To be well prepared, the inspector should review background information on the facility, including the regulatory status of the site. Is the site just a large quantity generator and is operating this corrective action under an order, or is it a TSDF? Does it have air or water permits? You should also look into the current and historic uses of the property, surrounding land uses. Is it in a residential area, commercial, or industrial area? And is groundwater being used for drinking water? And that's definitely a concern if it is being used. The inspector should review EPA tracking databases such as Recro, Info, Echo, and TRI. The TRI database will indicate releases to air, water, and land that the company is responsible to report out. And Echo provides compliance history and any recent history of noncompliance with RCRA or other programs should be a red flag for your inspection. As you prepare for the inspection, it is important to review key documents including permits and orders, approved work plans, a site map, again, that identifies the SMUs and ALCs, previous inspections or site visit reports, field notes and observations, aerial and on-site photographs in the site file, the environmental indicator forms and memos, remedy implementation or construction complete reports, monthly, quarterly, and or annual reports. In addition, company records such as regulatorily required inspections and maintenance and repair records should be reviewed. During your inspection preparation, you should contact other agencies, state, EPA, or local health departments for reports of spills or complaints, odor complaints. You should research the site using Google, Google Earth, Bing, or other web-based research tools. One specific research or search term I've been using when I prepare for inspections includes the facility name, the city, and the word spill or fire, and or fire. Sometimes there'll be information out there publicly available that you're not aware of, and a simple search will help you identify such events. Also, it's important to obtain widely available data about the property or site from the internet. Just searching the site name and location will sometimes provide extra information that you weren't aware of. Web-based aerial photographs may be more current than the file copy, so it's good to use the different search engines to look at aerial photographs. The aerial photographs show impoundments, tanks, outdoor barrels, management, and any ponding that might be of interest during your inspection. It's good to have that knowledge before you get out to the site. And one of the tools we have to use is Google Earth here in the region. And Google Earth will allow you to do a review of aerial photographs in a time series, so you can go back in time as long as the photo is available. You can look at how it looks today compared to how it looks, for example, 20 years ago, if that information is available. It is kind of a neat thing that Google Earth does. And lastly, you should obtain information from the National Response Center. A company is required to notify reportable quantity it releases to NERC. If you have time, it's good to review inspection reports and data from other environmental programs. Air and water permits and inspections and associated records often add site details and information that's not normally captured by the RCRA process. During your preparation, you should be developing an inspection game plan. Clear objectives and scope of the inspection should be fully developed prior to the inspection. All the main inspection points should be identified. The tour areas should be scoped out. Interview topics or questions could be outlined before you get out there. Documents reviewed at the site during the inspection should be listed. And site-specific checklists should be developed or applicable generic corrective action checklists should be secured for use during your inspection. And if sampling is anticipated, a sampling quality assurance and safety plans must be developed. As a person that's done inspections and corrective action for the last 17 years of my career at the EPA, I do strongly feel that the more time you prepare, the better the results you will have during and after your inspection. I think right now this is a time for another poll question. Is that correct, Zena?
I think it is. And here it comes. If you all could answer this quickly, and I'm going to look to see if there's some other questions that have come in. Suzanne has asked, How are sites identified or recommended for corrective action? Mike, can you answer that?
Well, for here in Region 5, we've done various exercises. Of course, any TSD, any treatment storage disposal facility that has a permit may have corrective action requirements in the permit. If there's no sign of releases, maybe the corrective action is delayed. And then the other facilities that had interim status but never got a permit, we have identified a list of sites like of those sites. And then in Region 5, I think it's nationally it's occurred that there's a ranking of these sites that had interim status. These sites are subject to RCRA 3008H authority. And by ranking the sites, we've started addressing the high-ranked sites where there is basically documented releases through the facility investigation PA, PAVSI, preliminary assessment, visual site inspection. That was used to then rate the site, and if it rated high, that's how we identified the list of sites that needed corrective action in the first instance. Anybody else want to chime in on how it works if I didn't quite capture the question? Feel free to do so. And I'm blaming on my cold if I seem like I'm rambling. I might ramble normally, but just with this cold, I'm a little more foggy than normal.
It's fine, Mike. All right, so looking at the poll question, yes, most folks have gotten it correct that the government, EPA or state, does make the final decision about the remedy for the facility. Mike, I hope you're ready for a few more slides.
Yes, turn it back to you. I'm just going to take a drink of water here. Next, I'll be discussing conducting an inspection, including accessing the site, record review, and touring the site, documenting the inspection. Possible violations of corrective action requirements may be present during any phase of the corrective action, in the RFI, the CMS, the CMI phase, O&M phase. Record inspections are generally unannounced to give the inspector a true picture of the site and its operations. On-site inspections must take place during normal business hours per the RCRA 3000, Section 3007 inspection authority. On occasion, special coordination and notice will be given of an inspection to a site. For example, when the site is no longer operating, it's under corrective action, but there's nobody on-site. Of course, special coordination and contacting the facility representatives before the inspection would be required. However, short notice of the inspection should be considered when it has to be announced, and that will allow you to get a better picture of the true picture of the site operations, and it doesn't give them as much time to correct any violations. Sorry, I was having a little problem there with clicking. EPA's general practice is for an inspector to present his or her credentials and issue a notice of inspection to the establishment owner or person in charge of the facility at the time of inspection. Inspectors are authorized by law to conduct inspections. Inspectors advise not to provide any personal information, including badge number, driver's license number, or home address prior to or during an inspection. The case attorney should be aware of the inspection and be prepared to seek an administrative warrant quickly if the owner-operator denies access to all or any part of the facility. During the document review, you should review schedules under the permit order, work plan, and determine if schedules have been met, including the engineering control, construction, institutional controls, financial assurance. You should review monitoring and monthly reports to understand site contamination and controls, the type of equipment and remedies being used for cleanup, operation and maintenance requirements for the systems. During the document review, note any potential violations, especially any failure to operate or maintain remedies documented in the company records. Copy these records or reports that indicate noncompliance or further tell the story of your inspection. And also copy documents that need additional time to review offsite. During the site tour, you should be looking for any releases at SMOOS or AELCs and any new area that might be managing waste that's not covered by the order or permit. You should tour raw material loading and unloading areas, obviously looking for any mismanagement. You should inspect secondary containment structures for signs of compromise, cracks, as example. Waste storage areas should be toured looking for any mismanagement, track out, run on, or run off. If you do observe a release, you should gather as much information as possible about it. You should estimate the size of the release, note dead vegetation and animals, record the waste or chemical product and the unit the release is from, take numerous photographs from various angles, try to provide a perspective in the pictures. If you have some sort of person or thing in the picture, it sometimes helps estimate the size or give a perspective to somebody that reviews the photographs back at the office. In this slide here is actual a release from a solid waste management unit at a corrective action site. I was actually at the site doing just a normal compliance evaluation inspection, and I was aware of that it had corrective action obligations. I probably didn't prepare as much as I should have for that part of it, but I was aware enough that, you know, this is a release at the site. I took pictures of it, estimated the size. It was approximately 20-foot by 20-foot stained soil area with dead vegetation. There were no dead animals. I got information about the material as waste from wastewater treatment unit that was a SMOO. The company did not report the release to EPA as it was required by the order, and we did end up sending a notice of violation citing this and other violations to the company. If you are prepared to, you should sample any release. If not, you may need and you need more information. It's best to go back to the office and prepare the sampling plans and all the other required plans and sample the release as soon as possible. It is important to document the cause of release. Like I mentioned in this example, the company claimed that it was a big rain event, one of those historic rain events that overflowed their system, and I was able to go back into the weather records and confirm their explanation of the event. Another important question to ask the company is how did they clean it up and how did they clean it up and dispose of the waste? It's important to get copies of the MSDS, chemical analysis, internal and external reports, and any other information the company has related to the release. For each solid waste management unit or area concerned, the inspector should review what types of inspection reports are required, check the dates and status of such inspection reports, what maintenance is required for that measure, and if they are compliant with the corrective action requirements. Are they maintaining it? Are they do the required inspections? For each CAMU, the inspector should review what type of stabilization is used. The integrity cap, you should walk over the cap looking for trees or unwanted vegetation. Check for erosion and slumping of the cap. Note any ongoing maintenance or lack of maintenance. Another item that you can inspect, you should inspect, is the placement, integrity, and operation, all status of monitoring wells. Sometimes a company is neglecting the maintenance of a well, or it's no longer operational, and they have not notified EPA of such status of the having notified the EPA of the status of the well. Any fencing or security systems should be evaluated to ensure no unauthorized access is occurring. And again, I mentioned as an example, one of a recent Region 5 inspections of a capped unit, there were people with unauthorized access to it riding motorcycles across it. So we had to get the company to fix that problem. The people are accessing it through a fence, and we had to change the behavior, obviously. During the tour issues, you should verify land and groundwater uses compared to institutional controls. You should inspect the management of remediation waste. Some of the items you may be inspecting include inceptor trenches, pump and treat systems, run-on and run-off controls, temperature controls for treatment units, erosion or poor vegetative cover and caps. You should review nearby receptors and any mechanisms that are in place to monitor or control exposures. The human health and groundwater controlled EI should be evaluated during your tour. Is there any evidence that the company is digging through a cap without making sure their workers are protected, as an example? If the inspection is part of a multimedia inspection, violations of air or water permits may be relevant to corrective action. It is important to thoroughly document your inspection. Every part of an inspection is gathering evidence, so it's extremely important to be organized. Keep detailed notes, including time, place, and who was present. Complete appropriate checklists, photograph tour points, copy documents showing possible noncompliance, maintain chain of custody of samples and documents, and be accurate when taking the statements. You should attribute statements and to people and don't assume words or viewpoints. The better you document your inspection, the more weight that is given to the evidence, which increases your credibility as a witness in a legal matter. I think, again, this is another pause point for questions.
Yeah, I've got a couple. Phil wants to know, would you take a sample of the dead animal for chemical analysis?
Well, it depends what the animal is. I think you could capture that. If it's a migratory bird, you have to have a permit to take it actually off-site. I've worked closely with Fish and Wildlife Services to actually investigate a site that had an oil pond where birds were landing and dying. I wouldn't be able to actually take the birds, but the Fish and Wildlife was able to. They take them back to their office, and they can do, I don't know if it's an autopsy or what it is, but I think documenting the dead animal is more important. I would be cautious of taking it. I don't know how you would dispose of it once you got it back to the lab or what you would do with it. If it starts to stink, what would you do? So I guess okay. If you're interested in taking animals, you should be prepared to how make sure you know how to manage it once you get it back to your office.
Good point. And another question, SOAD wants to know, do you go with someone else for safety reasons? Do you have to have two people on an inspection, or can you go solo?
So in Region 5, the record inspectors often go solo. And I think it's more for travel money and all that kind of stuff. So I encourage going more than one person going on inspection. It's good to have more than one set of eyes, and sometimes one person is better asking questions and one person is better at taking notes. And that's the case for me. I'm better at actually asking questions, and I'm not as good as about taking notes. My notes are chicken scratching. So I always encourage more than one person going out on an inspection.
All right. And one last question. You mentioned the checklist, corrective action checklist. Do you have one that you use? Is there a generic one that EPA has put out there for people to use?
Mm-hmm. We have one in draft. I don't know where that is at this point. I suppose it's something that we should probably follow up on and provide it. What I've found when I've been recently doing some of these O&M inspections, that the site-specific documents are better for me to conduct an inspection because it doesn't have as much extraneous information. Corrective action is so site-specific, and to capture all the compliance points, the inspection, the draft check and inspection checklist is pretty big, and you'd only fill out certain sections of it. Whereas, again, with the most recent inspection I had, they had the remedies were in place, and they had their own internal checklist that they're supposed to do. So I was able to use their checklist, blank versions of them, to evaluate the cap of the landfill, the cap of the soil, and also the wells and things that they should have been documenting. And apparently they were missing some of them. So I haven't finished the enforcement action on that, but we did notice some of the problems that they weren't doing their O&M at the site.
And I know that there are checklists around. You probably would want to network, maybe contact some of your other state colleagues or EPA folks for those of you that are in state offices and see if there are some things like that that have already been developed so you don't have to reinvent the wheel.
Yeah, and that's a very good point. I know there are some of our states do have corrective action inspection checklists, and we modeled our version off of theirs. So you don't have to recreate the wheel if you don't.
All right, thanks.
Mm-hmm. Are we moving on to the next part?
Yeah, let's go ahead and keep going. I believe Chuck's up next. Is that right?
Well, no, yeah, actually, unfortunately, you have me some more.
Oh, you're going to do this too. Okay. And then we'll have Chuck. Okay, thanks.
Yeah. Sorry, y'all. So when you prepare a corrective action inspection report, you should tell a story. You should begin with the end in mind. Understand what information is needed to determine the compliance with or approve violation of corrective action obligation. In my opinion, all site corrective action site visits should have a report. Even if the visit is not intended to be inspection, documented observations may be evidence of compliance or referenced by future inspections to determine any change in conditions. Use a narrative description as well as clear and concise language when writing your report. Support the story with evidence obtained during the inspection. Identify potential problems and deviations from requirements. Confirm any noncompliance with legal staff and the project manager. And because noncompliance may result in enforcement action by the regulatory agency, the appropriate response needs to be decided by the case team after inspection, including if any emergency response is appropriate if you identify, for example, a new release. Unfortunately, my computer is telling me I need to update Microsoft Office 2013. I'm pushing snooze now, and hopefully it won't keep on bothering me. Here is an example or outline of the contents of an inspection report. We understand that every region and state office does a little different variation, so this is just an example. Typically, an inspection report will have the general information about the site, a narrative summary of the inspection, identification of the potential issues, and attachments or appendices. The general information recorded in your report should include the facility name, address, phone number, type of facility, and description of the corrective action status at the time of the inspection, the data of the inspection, the start and end times, facility representatives' names, title, contact information, the same information for the inspectors. If there is any state or federal coordination of the inspection, the purpose and scope of the inspection, any information you might have provided to the facility, which may include that you showed your credentials, that you're following the proper procedures, any compliance assistance information you may have provided, and documentation that you discussed the company can claim material they produce or information you gathered as confidential business information. The narrative summary of the inspection report must include a description of the corrective action activities being performed and then items evaluated, the items that you actually inspected. It should describe the tour, the photographs taken, any sampling, documents that were reviewed, including summary of documents copies, and the contents of the closeout meeting of the inspection. You should identify potential problems and deviation from corrective action requirements in your report. For each potential violation, identify the requirements of the order or permit and evidence you gather that supports violation of a violation determination. As an example, if the company is failing to maintain extraction wells according to their work plan, you should identify what the work plan says about the extraction wells. How were the wells non-compliant? Had they shut down? They weren't operating. You should provide photographs of the wells. You document the statements from the employees about the wells and any facility records showing repair was needed, especially over a long period of time. The duration and seriousness of a violation can be determined by how long the company knew of an issue, who knew of the issue, were the facility contacts aware of the issue, and how long the company failed to rectify it. In your report, you should attach all the photos taken, the documents copied, and any sampling data collected at the time of the inspection. The completed checklist and the order or permit section or decision document requirements evaluated during the inspection. Attaching this information, if it is a routine business practice in your office, will facilitate authenticating the evidence if the matter goes to trial or hearing. If the matter is reassigned, loose records may be lost or out of order, which may impair authenticating the evidence in a legal matter. In summary, if you thoroughly prepare, conduct, and document your corrective action inspection, the better the results should be if there is a case developed from your work. And I believe, again, this is an opportunity for questions.
Yeah, we've got a couple more questions coming in. This is probably a question for the headquarters folks on the line. Brad wants to know if EPA is considering developing some inspection commitments for the authorized states on their corrective action sites, maybe that have completed remedial efforts with institutional controls or CAMUs, that kind of thing. Phil or Peter, do you have an answer for that?
This is Phil. I'm not aware of any. That comes probably out of the program office, but I don't think so, but I could be wrong on that.
Yeah, we'll check on that and get back. Somebody else asked a question. For facilities in CMI, so that's the last section, are CAIs more analogous to O&Ms and five-year reviews? Or are there some things CAIs can't answer but can only be done in a five-year review?
I'm not sure if I understand the question. I think there's discussion about having some sort of regularly scheduled inspection of sites that are in O&M. In 5 years is the frequency for, I know Superfund, they reevaluate every 5 years, and then for large quantity generators, the goal is to visit large quantity generators every 5 years. I think there have been discussions on that. I don't know if that answers the question. I'm not sure if I understand it.
Okay, thanks. And I think at this point we'll go ahead and turn it over to Chuck for the next section.
Great, thanks. I think it's a little dangerous to give an attorney extra time during any presentation, but we'll just go ahead, and thankfully you've put me at the end so I can't drive too many of the participants away. I'd like to add my thanks to the participants today. There are a large number, and the questions that are coming in are great. And I'd like to thank the presenters who've gone before me for doing such a good and thorough job. By way of further introduction to the folks who don't know me out there, I've been doing corrective action enforcement primarily for Region 8 in Denver's office since the very early 90s. I've been involved in EPA and state lead sites under all types of authorities, from the most informal through to the most formal. I've worked on sites that are extremely small and extremely large and complex, some that have been addressed quickly, and unfortunately a number that move extremely slowly. As an attorney, of course, I haven't really done any inspections, but I have been privileged enough to visit a number of the facilities that I am the attorney on. And as folks have said before, it's important to work with your attorneys as early as you can in the process, because when you believe you may have an enforcement situation or a potential enforcement situation, often there'll be a number of potential enforcement responses ranging from the most informal through to the most formal, and you'll want to understand which of the tools are applicable, whether or not the authority exists for you and your agency to take the actions that you want to, whether there's jurisdiction in this particular set of potential violations. And as early as possible, you're going to want to think about the burden of proof. And the burden of proof is really broken up into two pieces. Legal, I guess, language would have you say it, so that there's a burden of production. So when you want to allege a violation, you have to have enough evidence that you can produce to at least show, without the other side rebutting it, that you have enough to make your case. And then eventually you have to have enough to persuade. The burden of persuasion has to be met. You have to persuade the decision maker that you have enough evidence to conclude that there is a violation. And so the earlier that you understand your burdens, your evidentiary burdens, the more likely you are to successfully gather, develop, maintain the evidence to support the violation. And different evidence can include things like your field notes and your observations. Photos are always valuable. Existing company records, statements made by employees, as Mike said, I believe, it is critically important that you document the name, time, place when you hear statements either off the cuff or in response to your question by employees regarding just about everything. But you know, in this context, obviously, we're thinking about evidence for violations. Obviously, sampling test results and any other records that relate to either the requirement itself or the act or omission that may be the violation. Those can be obtained, as the previous presenters have said, from the company, from the employees, and frankly, they may already exist in EPA, state, or other governmental offices. And I'll add, too, that on occasion, citizens may also have viable information. You have to proceed carefully with information you do get from the public, though, but you should be careful about all the information you believe may be evidence. Let's see. There we go. So once you believe that that a violation may exist, the first thing you do is determine whether an enforcement action may or may not be necessary. Often, if there's a good working relationship or otherwise with the company, a simple phone call can clear up potential problems or misunderstandings. But often that doesn't quite work, and you have to take a look around and see what other information and evidence is available to help support your choice of enforcement response. One of the key factors, of course, is has the company or the person engaged in this type of behavior before, or do they just generally have a pattern of blowing off deadlines, not living up to their obligations, et cetera. Once you determine that some type of response is necessary, the range is from the least formal, which actually is the telephone call and letting them know that they're out of compliance, to documenting it in writing in the form of a non-compliance letter or an NOV or some other form of informal letter saying, hey, we've noticed this, please fix it. We can also go out and gather more information using, EPA would use Section 3007 of RCRA to gather additional information and say, hey, we believe that there may or may not be a violation out there. Please gather the following evidence or information and submit it within a set period of time. We can also issue administrative orders under a number of authorities in the context of an existing enforceable mechanism that includes them. We could demand stipulated penalties, and EPA, of course, can also decide to request that DOJ initiate a formal enforcement action in federal district court. Okay, as you are determining, as you're taking your steps in a more formal enforcement situation, there are, beyond, figuring out which elements or requirements that they violated and then documenting them, what you need to do also is determine which penalty provisions may apply, whether they're in the enforceable mechanism or in the statute or regs, and develop an appropriate penalty calculation. Try to figure out what relief is absolutely necessary to resolve the violations. And in some contexts, you also may need to think beyond just the relief, which may or may not be necessary under the existing mechanism, but additional actions that may be required because of based on the noncompliance. They all do have to be tied to the noncompliance itself, but especially if you're in front of a judge and worse harm has occurred because of the violations, those harms can be remedied, and the court can order them. I want to take a half a step back because obviously the vast majority of enforcement actions do result in settlements rather than litigation. And so people sometimes think, well, this isn't going to go to trial anyway, so my evidence doesn't have to be as meticulous as it might otherwise be to support a penalty calculation, or even just to help the judge come to the conclusion that the violation has occurred. But the truth is that the better the evidence, the better the outcome. Whether it's a litigation outcome or a settlement, once the other side sees that you do have enough evidence to prove your case, so to speak, and they have some interest in coming back into the compliance and avoiding a judge's decision, the better the evidence, the better the settlement you get will be. Obviously, sometimes you're looking to penalty numbers for their deterrent effect, but you also want to get the best possible action in the most appropriate time frame. And so the best evidence really can support that. As part of settlements, a number of things that are common to traditional regulatory violation settlements are also appropriate on a case-by-case situation to include in a settlement of a corrective action violation situation. Things like supplemental environmental projects might be appropriate. Region 8 has a long history of including financial assurance requirements in our financial assurance mechanisms, But even we and a number of our states don't always include them in our, or don't always have them in our older orders, et cetera. But if it seems appropriate in a settlement to bring in a financial assurance requirement, that's as good a time as any to try to get financial assurance applicable to that particular corrective action situation. And of course, we can often refer, as the case goes along, sometimes the violative behavior becomes apparent that it's more and more egregious. Even though you're in the middle of a case, you should always consider a criminal or referral over to the criminal folks if appropriate. But in terms of additional things to consider in settlement, you can consider green remediation approaches. That's an emerging subfield in the cleanup world. But also, although OECA and EPA has been championing the idea of next generation compliance for a few years, there's more and more of a focus being put on that. And I'm going to add another plug for considering next gen compliance in corrective action settlements. I think a particularly appropriate place is where contamination continues to migrate off-site, whether that's the non-compliance or not. I think that's a good situation for considering some next-gen tools. Excuse me. Because I have a few minutes, I will make a quick note of a reference to criminal investigations or referring things to criminals. We've had a long cleanup under a RCRA consent decree at a large and complicated facility, although it wasn't discussed today, the first step that we had the company conduct was a CCRA, a current conditions release assessment report, for them to develop one. And what that basically is a requirement that they gather all existing environmental data, compile it in a report, analyze its usefulness for corrective action purposes, and let us know which data they already have, if any, may or may not be useful. Well, 10 years into the process, they did submit a current conditions release assessment report, and we went on with our business. But 10 plus years into the process, we found out that they did have significant information that was not included. It would have ironically saved them money in the investigations, but they were more interested in stringing the process out for as long as possible. And some of this information would have allowed us to make some at least preliminary conclusions, and in fact would have led to a good, robust discussion on whether additional interim measures to the ones that were already underway would have been appropriate under the circumstances early on. So they thought they were saving money, but in fact they ended up spending more. That case never got prosecuted and settled because it turned out criminal already had a different investigation ongoing, and they wrapped everything up in one, but didn't really mention that document violation in the settlement. So moving on to a couple of case examples, in enforcement case examples in particular, there's a facility in the middle of the country that was subject to a RCRA 3008H interim status corrective action order. They had a number of requirements, including pumping and treating groundwater. They failed to maintain their pumps, which led to drinking well water contamination, which of course is particularly egregious when a pathway is broken by corrective action work and then it's recompleted by failure to stay on track. And eventually a consent agreement and final order, so that's an administrative case, with a penalty for $650,000 was agreed upon by the company and the agency. So there are times when you can see violations that are quite significant and you can get significant outcomes, and one can probably more than hope that the company that paid a $650,000 fine was more inclined to continue to comply in the future and to fix the problem. I see that I am just about out of my time, but before I turn it over to Zena, I will say for the folks who are newer to corrective action that there are a number of circumstances where people think that corrective action, even though it could be a good tool, may or may not be appropriate. And I have two quick examples for you. One of them is sometimes at CERCLA sites, RCRA is applicable and corrective action may be appropriate. Every CERCLA site is different, of course, and but it is something worth discussing. It isn't worth dismissing the idea that corrective action isn't a valuable, or to conclude corrective action won't be valuable at a site merely because it's subject to existing corrective action CERCLA authority. And then last but not least, to the extent that you all interact with your criminal folks, it's hard for people pursuing criminal hazardous waste violations to figure out how to wrap in long-term corrective action responsibilities. But we have in Region 8 one excellent example of an interim status corrective action order that was negotiated simultaneously with a major plea agreement. And as a condition of probation, the company agreed that they would comply with that corrective action order. And with that, I think I will turn it over to Zena.
Thanks a lot, Chuck. I was looking to see if there's other questions. And there's one question about slide 54, if those of you that have that could take a look. I'll flip back to it. Several folks asked about this slide. What is this a picture of? And so I asked Mike, and I don't know if he wants to give any more details, but he said this was a situation where...
I can talk a little bit about it.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, since we have this is a subtitle D landfill that took some waste that ended up being water reactive waste. And when they started recirculating their leachate, that it caused these geysers, the steam geyser. So it ended up actually being more of a Superfund type of response, emergency type of response, but just an example of waste mismanagement. And this is a capped landfill that ended up being problematic that needed, a response. I just thought it was a neat photo. So
it is. It is very unique. And Phil, do you want to take us home with the last couple of slides?
Yeah. If I have the power to advance. Yeah, if you could. Just want to highlight throughout this entire presentation, people talked about groundwater contamination, groundwater monitoring, and Region 3 provided some additional resources. Additional references concerning groundwater issues, and so I would refer you to them. And then the last slide just is a summary. We talked about the RCRA corrective action process as a whole and what it means and the various stages in there. Tammy did a great job of explaining the various stages. And then we talked about the preparation, inspection, and reporting and developing the case, and all of these things have to work together. So it was a nice job by everybody, and it takes a lot of work to go out and conduct an inspection, but it's worth it for several reasons. One, if you get a cleaner environment, and that's what we're after in these, and if you have to take a enforcement action, then you have the materials to support that enforcement action. Want to highlight one other thing in the slide that you were sent out when you registered. There are notes pages, and the notes from a lot of the notes are on these notes pages, and so you're able to see kind of what the presenters were talking about. So want to thank everybody for your participation and staying on for a couple hours, and definitely thank the presenters and both Zena and Gene for their work, the technical work behind the scenes. So that does it for us. Gene, do we need to do anything else?
Yeah, I'll walk through final reminders with our participants just to be sure they understand how they can download the slides, submit feedback, and access the recorded version of today's session. I just want to be sure that you and Zena don't have any other final reminders for your audience before I start those instructions.
I'm good, thanks.
Okay. Well, with that, I'm going to walk everybody through just one or two more final slides. I also want to echo the thanks to all of the instructors who helped make today's webinar happen. I also want to thank the 480 individuals who participated live during today's online broadcast. We had a great turnout, and we're glad you were able to join us. We oftentimes get requests for training records for those of you that are looking to document and keep track of webinars that you may have participated in. If you fall into that particular need, we do have a website that's available on the CLUIN website. You can go to that URL and actually enter in your email address, and we will automatically send a table by email to that email address listing all of the webinars that you've attended live. So you can use that URL to continue to track and look up your training records directly through our website. If you're looking for copies of the materials that were presented today, including detailed speaker notes, as Phil mentioned, you'll find that available to download. We've placed it right on the seminar homepage. That's the same place that you checked in for today's webinar. It's also listed as one of the seminar resources. And I would ask if you could take just a short moment and fill out our online feedback form. We do read each and every one of those responses to help us to continue to deliver free online training like this. If you shared the line with multiple participants, each person can actually fill out their own online feedback form. There'll be a link that will appear once you fill out that form to let you fill out a form for someone else. You can also check a box on that short form. It's circled in red in this illustration. As long as your email address is entered correctly and you check that box, you'll receive an automated confirmation email that will at least verify you shared feedback after the live event. For those of you looking to document your participation today for either CEUs or PDHs, we don't issue those particular certificates through CLUIN. However, you may find if you fill out the feedback form and get that confirmation email, keep a copy of the materials and or your registration email, that's usually enough to document your attendance to earn those credits with your own accrediting institution. If you have any additional questions, again, you can reach out to me directly at ballant.gene@epa.gov. Many thanks to the instructors who joined us and those nearly 480 individuals who signed on for the live broadcast. Once the recorded archive of today's webinar is available, you will receive an automatic email with the link and instructions on how to replay it online, and you'll be welcome to forward on to anyone else that you think will find it to be a valuable expenditure of your time. This will be the formal conclusion for today's live broadcast.